It recorded.
Welcome, everyone, to our second session with Dr. Stephen Crocco on living lives against the grain. Last week was really wonderful, and if you didn't catch it, you weren't here, you can watch the recording. And now Steve will open us with prayer.
Let us pray. Gracious God, for the beauty of your world, for the potential of this day, for your constant stream of gifts and blessings, we give you thanks. Be with us now as we consider matters of importance to your church. Bless our words, our thoughts, and above all, our deeds. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. My pleasure to be back again with you. Some of you know that last Sunday I got on a plane to go to Las Vegas. From there, a friend and I went through five national parks in Utah, and I got home at midnight last night. So I'm raring to go this morning. Just a very brief review. Last week I talked about it's obvious how divided we are as a culture. And I talked about a number of rhetorical tricks and tactics that confuse and complicate things. And they're used by everybody. And I was making a case that one of the tasks of a Christian should be to not be subject to these tactics, to call for truth, to call for honesty, to call for looking at different sides of an issue. I talked about how words have different meanings. People use words like justice. I'm for justice. Well, who isn't for justice? But people have very different ways of getting at justice. Or I talked about fallacies that people make all the time. President Biden is a senile old man. His ideas can't be any good. That's an ad hominem argument. Donald Trump is a crazy man. He's Hitler. Well, his ideas can't be any good. That's an ad hominem, against the person kind of argument. There are better ways to think than to succumb to those kinds of things. I talked a little bit about how we Presbyterians in the PCUSA value being prophetic. We want to speak truth to power, but we rarely speak truth to ourselves or allow someone to speak truth to us because we're so convinced that we have the truth about political issues, social issues. So I want us to look into our own traditions some. And I use the example of what's often called white Christian nationalism as an example of some of the ways that people use that term as a boogeyman. That's another fallacy. Where does a boogeyman come from? You tell your kids, if you don't go to sleep, the boogeyman is going to get you. You scare people. And while white Christian nationalism is real, I think it's often used as a boogeyman kind of argument. Next week, I want to talk about this whole thing is called living against the grain. How do we think against the grain? And then the final week, if we get there, is how do we live in terms of what actions do we take against the grain? Next slide, please. This is just to get us started. I want us to think about a story. We have a story to tell to the nations, a story of truth and mercy, a story of peace and light. Christians are people with stories. And we're stories of Moses in the desert and Jesus' teachings and the crucifixion and resurrection. But can we tell it without letting culture wars and political partisanship unduly dictate the terms of our ideas and conversations? Next slide, please. As Christians, we are people who've been on the move literally for thousands of years, also culturally and intellectually. We trace our roots back to the Exodus from Egypt to the Promised Land, 3,000 years ago, the exile from Israel to Babylon, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and then the Jewish and Christian diaspora after the destruction of Rome in 70 AD. And where do we go from there? Next slide, please. We conquered the Mediterranean world for Jesus while being subordinate to Caesar. It's an amazing thing. And Paul in Rome wrote this passage, "Let every soul be a subordinate to the higher authorities, for there is no authority except under God, and such as exist are subordinated to God. So he who opposes authority has opposed God's ordination, and those who have made opposition will invite a verdict upon themselves." In other words, Paul said, you have to submit yourself to the authorities, to Rome, not forever in all things, but as a way of life. That's how Christians were to live. Because God ordained, God uses authorities for God's purposes. And you can see how Christianity spread around the Mediterranean Sea in a very short period of time. But not only that, next slide, please. I'm getting the hang of this next slide thing. I like that. If you look at the previous map, it's about the same thing. Western civilization is the story of three civilizations: the Greeks, the Hellenized Romans, the Romans influenced by the Greeks, and the Christianized Greco-Romans laid the foundation of European civilization that has been, for good or ill, and good and ill, I should say, a dominant force in our world, leading to the spread of the Christian church. There's an overlap there, and Christianity is inexorably tied to Western civilization. It's one of the pillars of Western civilization, again, for good or bad. Next slide, please. And Christianity has spread around the world. The darker the area, the more prevalent Christianity is. And the only places in the world where it's not sort of dominant would be sub-Saharan Africa or Saharan Africa, and then India and China. So Christianity is a world religion, and we have spread. So we are players in the world. Next slide, please. The church has survived in nearly every setting: tribes, clans, nations, empires. It's thrived in most, but not in all of them. And I picture right below that of the murders going on in Nigeria right now, where lots of Christians are being, apparently, I should say apparently, because no one knows anything really for sure, but apparently being killed. The Nigerian government denies it, but others, I don't want to go down that path right now. The picture on top is of a church in Egypt. Christians occupy about 10% of the population in Egypt. The church has certain rights there, but try to build a new church in Egypt, it's very difficult. Try to get permission to expand your church, it's very difficult. And this is a picture of the underground church in China. Some would call it the pure Christian church, not the church influenced by the Chinese Communist Party. So the church has survived. Next slide, please. The church has failed in every setting too. Here we go back to the Nazis. Where would we be, for examples, without the Nazis? I mean, it's awful. But the church, here you have these Lutheran bishops pledging allegiance to the Nazi Reich. And then this picture, I don't know what the story is behind the picture on the right, but it's a Southern Baptist church. And I picked it to symbolize the difficulty of integrating churches. So the church has had its failures. Next slide, please. And we know that God does not leave us alone. Of course, Martin Luther King, he always gets, it's a great, you know, what a legacy that he had. Anybody recognize the picture on top? I wouldn't either. It was Corrie Ten Boom. Do you know her story? You know, she hid Jews in her home in Holland, was betrayed by a neighbor and sent to Auschwitz. And I believe she survived that war, survived Auschwitz. But God does not leave us alone. And that's one of the great things about the church. Next slide, please. I give this speech every time I have a chance. Tell anybody, if you hate somebody politically, I'm not saying you, I'm just being hyper, you know, hypothetical. If you hate somebody, the worst thing you can do is to kill them. Make martyrs out of them. So if you really hate Jews, don't kill them. If you really hate Charlie Kirk, don't kill him. It's just common sense, but people somehow feel that their little action, expression of their individuality and their own hate and rage, is going to make their cause better. It only makes your cause worse. So no violence. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It's how things spread. Anyway, sermon over. Next slide, please. Yeah, this is a Living Against the Grain. How does God's story come to us? This is a book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind. Anybody know this book? You did, good. It's such a great book. It's one of, I put it in the top five books I've ever read in my life. And I just want to go over some of the basic points of it. And I've been a librarian my whole life, so that's to say something. All right, next slide, please. If you recall, Jonathan Haidt says that, you know, we all know we have taste buds where we can taste bitter and umami and sour and sweet and salty. He says we have moral taste buds. Everybody tastes the same things. And he names them care, fairness, loyalty, liberty, authority, and sanctity. We all taste them, but we don't all taste them the same way. If you can go to the next slide, please. And here they are again, calls it moral foundations theory. Haidt is a social psychologist, I think at NYU in New York, and is a, you know, devout liberal. Okay, next slide. And this is in this book, he says, this is what we value. And I had those passed out so you don't have to read that little tiny stuff up there. He says there are, you know, these six tastes. Care, harm, you know, is very sensitive to suffering and need. Liberty, oppression, anything that gets in the way of individual rights. Fairness, about reciprocity, anti-cheating. Loyalty, betrayal, it's about commitment to one's community. Authority and subordination, it has to do with hierarchies and preserving the status quo, and then sanctity and degradation has to do with certain things that we consider sacred or unclean. You know, during COVID, if you did not wear a mask, even after COVID, you were somehow polluting the world, and there was a great sensitivity to pollution. For other people, you know, there are any kind of chaos or uncleanness, or it's a moral taste. Now, the whole point of this exercise is that he would say the liberal moral matrix And then that's the more conservative. This is the way people were born. Many of us have had kids. Excuse me. Some kids just come out the way, a certain way. Other ways, they're taught. So either we're taught or we come out in a certain way. And everybody has these tastes. The lines represent the intensity of the tastes. And if you see the conservative side, they're all about the same. Conservatives, according to Haidt, they have about an equal amount of concern for all of these tastes. Liberals, more progressives, have an imbalanced concern where care and harm and liberty and oppression are really, really important to these people. Other ones are important too, but just not as important. And if you could, to illustrate this, if we had these, six squares up on a board somewhere, and I give everybody 10 little pressure-sensitive dots, if you were more, again, traditionally kind of a conservative personality, you put one on each one. Well, if you were more liberal, my wife is a performer and a music artist and all that. Artists tend to be more creative. They'd put all the dots on the other side, and they really wouldn't put any dots on the ones on like loyalty and patriotism and that sort of thing. We're just different. But this affects how we think, how we act, and there's no right position here. It's just how we are, according to Haidt. Now, my point would be, if you tend to be more socially conservative in this sense, you should ask yourself, are there times when I really need to emphasize something that really needs emphasis now? And if you tend to be more on the liberal side of things, I might say, is there a time now to really emphasize things you don't really care about in your own gut sense? So that's how this thing is functional. This is just a statement to say, this is kind of who people are, and people gravitate this way. There's no blame. There's no one better, no position better. Okay. Next slide, please. Oops, sorry. Just to illustrate, comma shouldn't be there. There are two equally Catholic sides in the debate over immigration. A lot of Roman Catholic organizations sort of lead the way in helping migrants enter countries and prepare and help them. So one side thinks that the imperative to welcome the migrant is what most needs emphasis today. The care-harm moral matrix, the liberty-oppression. The other side thinks that preserving law and order and the economic well-being of a community, the cultural identity of a nation, is what is currently most urgent. Two very plausible attitudes. So both can appeal to the moral premises rooted in the Catholic tradition. Their dispute is about how best to balance the various relevant considerations under contemporary circumstances. And this guy, Edward Fesser, says it's a matter of prudential judgment about which reasonable people can disagree. Does anybody disagree with that? Can reasonable people disagree about something like this? I think so. But in our heated world of the media and politics, there is no interest in saying, yes, I can see the point, no matter what side I'm talking about. This interest, it's an interesting article. It appeals, Pope Francis, who recently died, was a big advocate for sort of open borders and the rights of migrants to cross borders. And he cited certain teachings in the Catholic tradition. But there are other teachings that that do say that migration should take into account what a nation can actually absorb and at what cost a nation can absorb things. So that's just to say, to illustrate Haidt's point. Next slide, please. So just, I have a bunch of pictures here, maybe your family, your travels, where you went to school, this church, your office where you worked, your use of the internet. What I'd like us all to think at some point, what is your story? You know, let's say you meet someone new, someone at church or work, or go to heaven and Jesus says, well, welcome. Tell me your story. How did you get, tell me about your life. Well, how do you tell that story as it applies to your faith? And I think we could all tell that story. Influences in our lives, certain people who were really just there for us and just changed everything. Mistakes we made, decisions we made. What is your story? Next slide, please. And who is the person that God's call came to where you were? And who is that person now? You know, some of us, when I first became a Christian, I was a teenager. And I was one of those people that I really got converted. Thought, wow, this is great. And my behavior changed like that, certain things. And I was a different person. Other things didn't change then, and they haven't changed, 50 some years later. So, but who were you when God's call came? Who are you now? What has changed? What is different? These are all things worth thinking about. Next slide, please. I'm going to just quote Karl Barth one more time, Romans 12:2. Who am I and where do I stand? What am I doing and by what am I compelled? How is it with me? How is it with the clarity of the seriousness of my seeking the will of God, of my asking after that good and well-pleasing and perfect thing which is ascribed and applied to me here and now? How is it going with my soul? That was an old, in old days, and even in some Christian circles today, someone put their hand on your shoulder, brother, how is it with your soul? We don't talk that way, most of us anymore, but Christian people did that for a long time. And we sing songs about it is well with my soul. How is your life going? Where is it going? Very important questions. Next slide, please. How does your story fit with the larger Christian story in our city, country, and world? That couple sitting at a table, I'm imagining that one of them is an interviewer and writing down your story, maybe for a history of your church. How old is this church? How old? 48, so that's 50. It's going to have a 75th anniversary. Most churches will, talk about that. That's a significant thing. And there'll be interviews done, oral histories done about the old folks who were still around. And Laird Stewart is, I knew Laird when I was at Princeton. And then this book over here is an actual book. It's called A History of Christianity in Pittsburgh. It was written by Gary Smith, who was a professor of church history at, I want to say either Westminster or Grove City College, one of those two schools. What is your history? What is your story? Okay, next slide. All right, now this is going to take some time. Where are we in history? And I'm going to use a book by a guy named Rusty Reno called Return of the Strong Gods. Rusty has a PhD from Yale. He has taught theology for many years. He's also the editor of a journal called First Things, which tends to the conservative side of the Christian faith. But I think Rusty's book is really helpful because it kind of gives us a way to look at where we are culturally right now. I want to put some words up there. You don't have to read them because I'm going to basically read them for you. So we can go to the next slide. He talks about the open society. You know, after World War II, how many millions, 50 million people died. But Europe was plunged into chaos. The whole world was. The West, especially the United States, pushed an ideal of the open society. And the promise was by liberating ourselves from the old attachments to nation, to borders, to clan, and to religion. He called these things strong gods that had fueled centuries of violence. We could build a prosperous world freed from dogmas and managed by experts. And it worked pretty well for us. I've put this sort of a Norman Rockwell type picture up there. That's probably us, some of us when we were young. Church made sense. Most people went to church. There was post-war prosperity. We had to deal with communism as a nation, of course, but that worked pretty well for most of us. Next slide, please. And just to illustrate, sports became emphasized because it was better than fighting people, better to fight them on the field than fight them in a jungle somewhere. So this open society looked for ways to keep tensions down. And there were always tensions. You know, there were, like I said, we were engaged in a Cold War. There were racial problems in this country. But the emphasis was on tapping down strong emotional feelings about the nation and about religion. We had a civil religion that encompassed Judaism. It was what most Americans believed in. It's probably, you know, churches were full after the war. It's probably what led to the founding of this church. You know, prosperity after the war, suburbs were expanding. You know, church is probably a good example of this. Next slide, please. This open society's favorite song. You'll recognize him. John Lennon. Imagine there's no heaven, no religion. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. The need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. No strong gods. No country to live or die for. No religion to live or die for. No heaven, no hell. No possession. Imagine a world free of greed and hunger. That was the hope. All right, next slide, please. Recognize this show? Absolutely hysterical show, Frasier. At one point, Frasier and his brother try to get their father to go out to a fancy restaurant, and Frasier says, "Dad, this food is to die for." His father says, "Your country and family are to die for. Restaurants are for eating." Get the connection. We have used words like to die for to talk about food. And Frasier's father says, "Your country and your family, those are strong gods that we tended to tap down." Okay, next slide, please. This is, like I said, this is for me. There have been many gains in areas like the rights of women, civil rights. We've diminished groups like the Ku Klux Klan. But our elites, you know, they promoted, if not open borders, free migration or immigration, open markets, open minds, all designed to quell, lessen the power of the strong gods. We don't want strong feelings about religion to emerge. We don't want ultra-patriotism to emerge. We want to push those things, keep them aside. But to do that, the project has hardened into a set of dogmas that continue to eat away at the social solidarity rooted in family, faith, and nation. And while progressives worry about the return of fascism, our societies are dissolving from an assault on many things that many hold dear. I want you to get the sense there are fears among some of a return to fascism. It's one of those words you should never, ever use or understand without asking for a definition of it. There are some who fear return to fascism and some who fear an assault on the things they hold most dear. So we have these two forces. Okay, next slide, please. And this is a picture of a drag queen at a library with little kids. You know, and that was a big cultural brouhaha a while ago. But this push against fascism has promoted, you know, obviously migration, celebrating racial diversity, multiculturalism, globalism, pansexualism, transgenderism. And those efforts to push fascism away has caused disruptions among many people. Say, wait a minute, you know, what are you doing with my kids in school? You know, why are we, take, for example, multiculturalism says all cultures are equally valid. And many people saying, well, you know, not really. I mean, not all cultures are great, but there's good in every culture, but there's some cultures are just not helpful. So there's been a push and a pull and a fight and the effort to prevent strong gods from emerging. In order to do that, you push people far, they feel like their things they value the most deeply are being rejected, are being and you know the progressives have there have been many critics of Western culture. You know, Western culture is no better than anyone else. And then the more conservative folks say, well, I think it's better. It's one of the best, it's probably the best culture ever. It's not perfect, but what are you going to replace it with? So, and you probably remember, you know, when you get to this age, you have a name right in your mind and it just goes out the door. Jesse Jackson, remember his famous chant at Columbia, ho, 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 Western Civ has got to go. There are people who push that, but other people saying, well, what are you going to replace it with? So this is kind of where we are. There are people who say, and this is another one, diversity, not unity, is our strength. Well, there's a truth to that, but that one needs to be unpacked. What does that really mean to say diversity is our strength? Our diversity can be our strength if there's something that holds us together besides just diversity. I'm going to come to that event at some point. We've seen that the family definitions, you know, that we might have grown up with has changed drastically in our lifetimes. You know, there were always single people. who never married. They're always married people who never had children. But we all pretty much accepted that there were, that the family, the nuclear family, was a basic building block of civilization and a good thing. But there are cultures that don't value that as much. And in order to, that's a strong God. People die, fight for that, die for that. People have replaced the family with an individual as the basic unit of human life. What's important is the individual. Again, conflict. Next slide, please. Progressives fear the pendulum will swing back in the direction of fascism and are doing what they can to keep the pendulum pushing against the strong gods. And conservatives who are not interested in fascism, but they're desperate to free the institutions, family, nation, and faith that give life meaning. Okay, next slide, please. So my question is there room for mutual understanding? And that will be next week. If there's nothing to kill or die for, is there anything to live for? And fear of losing all that gives meaning in life versus there's a fear of some fear losing all that gives meaning in life. Others fear that some sort of fascism will take what gives them meaning. So there is this push, and I want to ask the question, can we understand each other? I'm not saying change our minds. Can we understand each other? Next slide, please. Inevitably, the pendulum, I believe things tend to do this. They will swing. People long to be part of a we, the fruit of shared loves that give life meaning. And I think the strong gods will return in one form or another. And our task, I would say, again, quote, this is Reno too, our task is to attend to those that inspire the best of our traditions, the best strong gods we have. Otherwise, if you try to squelch all these strong gods, something is going to happen, and the fear is the worst strong god, the darker gods, will return. Okay, next slide, please. So we have things like populism now. People pushing back a contested concept that emphasizes the idea of the common people, often in opposition to a perceived elite. And it's funny that in our political life, the Democrats talk about Republican elites and the Republicans talk about the Democratic elites. And, more basically, populism is associated with anti-establishment, anti-political sentiment. Okay, next slide. There's a resurgence of interest in the Latin Mass. And I grew up Roman Catholic until high school, and I never understood a word of the thing. But until it changed in the 60s, progressives fear it will symbolize the overturn. I got that wrong. It will symbolize the overturn of social gains made in the Catholic Church since the Vatican Council. Next slide. There's pushback on open borders. Despite large numbers of legal immigrants who come here every year, progressives turn conservative concerns about borders and taking care of American citizens first before others as, xenophobic, racist, and selfish. But this is where we are. We're pushing each other right now. Next slide, please. Push back on men and women's sports. It's out there. I mean, people are fighting over that right now. And, you know, for a conservative person, you know, women, this is not a woman. For progressive types, say, this woman, she claims to be a woman, she is a woman. And we're in the midst of all this now. And this is what we're living with. One is fearing if you change the definition of what a woman is, you will destroy what's most precious. And the other is saying, if you become hardline about this definition, you will invoke fascism. Kind of going back and forth. Next slide. Pushback on the 1619 Project, you know, which argued that the United States was founded in 1619 when the first African slaves came here. And there was a book called 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. And I have to give my second sermon of the morning. I'm sick of hearing that racism and slavery was America's original sin. It wasn't. It was our second sin. The first sin was the way we dealt with the native population. That's my thought. And unlike African Americans who have a big voice in our culture, the Native Americans have no voice. What's interesting to me is, why doesn't anybody care about the Native Americans? I spent a week in New Mexico, or in Utah, passed through a number of Indian reservations. Pretty bleak looking territory. What? And I'm gonna get to this next week. Why are some groups interesting and other groups uninteresting? Why? You know, if you really care about, you know, care and fairness are your big deals, and you're all about the 1619 Project, well, why not the Native population? That's an honest to goodness rhetorical question. All right, next slide, please. Sermon over. Fears of emerging strong gods, like the things people love most deeply, lead to deep concerns. You know, the nation, borders, race, religion, family, individualism, history and culture. These are the battlegrounds of our culture today. Is the nation fundamentally good or evil? Are borders meant to be open, or do they have meaning? You know, if you've been to Europe before and after change, remember going to Europe, you had to keep your passport handy all the time and go through these border crossings. And now, unless you're going to Switzerland, it's pretty much just go wherever you want to go. Things have changed. So these are the things we're fighting about. Next slide, please. Now, this is a parenthesis. What is American exceptionalism? You've all heard the term. What does it mean? Some would say it means America has been uniquely blessed by God. America is uniquely favored by God. America has a unique role to play in history. And it includes notions like the manifest destiny. Once our ancestors landed on the East Coast, it was their destiny to occupy the entire landmass that came to be known as the United States. Next slide, please. How is American exceptionalism true, and how is it not true? I would say America has been uniquely blessed by God. Yes, but every nation and people have been blessed uniquely. That is, in a different way, by God. I'd say America is uniquely favored by God. Yes, but all nations are favored by God in unique ways. We are favored differently than South Africa, let's say, or Brazil. America has a unique role to play in history, yes, but all nations have their own unique role to play in history. This country does not play the same role that Switzerland does, for example. It's not true in the sense that only America has been blessed by God. It's not true in the sense that America is the only nation favored by God today. It's not true that America is the only nation playing a special role in history. I think that's important. We got to get that, make sure that sets in. Next slide, I'm going to try to go a little deeper with it. Every nation is exceptional by virtue of its resources, its history, and calling. But how are nations best governed? And of course, that's Brazil, Switzerland. Anybody recognize the bottom? That's Cairo, modern day Cairo. They're all exceptional. They have different histories, different resources. But the question I'm going to look at briefly is how are they best governed? Next slide, please. Some are globalists. Again, globalism is a descendant of the old idea of empire. Believes that the world is best governed when nations surrender significant portions of their autonomy, certain economic, legal, and geopolitical concerns to a responsible body like the European Union. Common complaints about globalism are that it reduces cultural distinctives to tourism, ethnic food. It leaves the little man, the little person, without recourse when it comes to taking land, etc. And it tends to concentrate power in multinational corporations. Okay, that's globalism. That's obviously an oversimplification. That's the United Nations at the top. The next slide, please. How are Christians globalists? Well, we are in the sense that the kingdom of God, the outworking of God's redemptive plan, is global in nature, if not galactic. Anybody following that story about that weird meteor that's been crossing through our galaxy that doesn't really have a tail like other meteors and gives off a blue light? Well, people say, what would you say to an alien? Well, I would ask if it believes in God. Because God's redemptive plan is global, maybe galactic in nature. Christians are globalists in that sense. Next slide. Our sisters and brothers in Christ live in every part of the globe. And the New Testament teaches that our obligation to them is strong. We're globalists in that sense, too. And I'll talk about that next week. Next slide. Nationalism, by contrast, is a principle that regards the world as best governed when nations, which are descended from clans, are free to chart their own courses, cultivate their own traditions, pursue their own interests without interference. The common critiques of nationalism are that nationalists pursue paths at the expense of other nations, and that the world is just too complicated and interdependent for nations, for nationalism to work. And that's what one of the common, if you look up a definition of globalism online, let's say at Wikipedia, it'll be kind of neutral. If you look up nationalism, it will say, start with a neutral phrase like this, and then say, nationalism is at the expense of others. That's what real nationalism is. I'm not sure I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it's illustrated by this flight attendant. What do they say when they go through the safety thing when it comes to the masks? And then what? Yeah, put your mask on first and then help others. That's sort of the nationalist approach. You kind of take care of yourself and then help others. In other words, I don't think it's fair to accuse nationalism as a very general concept as being at the expense of others. All right, next slide, please. How are Christians nationalists? Well, I might have cut that off a little bit. I quote Jeremiah, it's that famous passage, Jeremiah 29:7. Thus says the Lord of hosts, all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses, plant gardens, take wives, have sons and daughters, seek the welfare of the city. I put clan, nation, empire, where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare, you will find your welfare. Now, if you are seeking the welfare of the city, where we are all exiles, we know that. If you're seeking the welfare of your city, it doesn't mean you're not seeking the welfare of others, but you are seeking the welfare of your city, your clan, nation, empire. Next slide. And another way that Christians are nationalists is that they're subject to civil authorities who rule particular nations and empires. Of course, we're subject to God. Of course, I mean, Paul knew that one, and Peter knew that one. He wrote this. You know, as servants of God, live as free people, okay? Honor everyone, right? Everyone, Christian, non-Christian. Everyone around the world, love the family of believers, wherever they are. But notice the last admonition, after fear God, honor the emperor. That's in a particular place. In that sense, Christians are nationalists. When I was at Princeton Seminary, we hired a president from Scotland. I don't know what it is with these Presbyterians in Scotland, but he kept talking about our Queen. And a few of us got to be saying to him, excuse me, sir, but it's your Queen, not my Queen. And we have a particular authority, and those authorities are linked to, among other things, nations. Next slide, please. Here's a question. We're supposed to honor the emperor, seek the good of the American nation. You know, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to pay our taxes. That's the big one for the emperor's sake. Supposed to do good deeds like this child planting a tree or something. Supposed to vote and supposed to pray. That's how we operate. That's how we seek the good of the nation. We do it differently. Let's go to the next slide, please. I'm going to talk briefly about this Christian nationalism again. The only book I've seen that makes the case for Christian nationalism is this one by Stephen Wolfe. And I bought it. Honest to goodness, I tried. I couldn't even read it. I didn't understand it. I gave it to the Pittsburgh Seminary Library. And then Marjorie Taylor Greene over here, who's getting interesting publicity recently, she refers to herself as a Christian nationalist. And I think it's worth asking, is this movement, are these nationalists, as i.e. not globalists who are Christians, or is there something called Christian nationalism? Oh, let's go to the next slide. And I think I'm going to stop for now, but let's just see what the next slide is. All right, I'm going to stop here. We only have a couple minutes left. Are there comments or questions? Well, yeah, please.
Every slide, everything was in juxtaposition of each other. Come see, come saw, you say, oh yeah, on both sides. So you make up your own mind.
Well, I'm going there. I'm trying to lay out the case that there are, we're living in this conflicted time, and the first part of these weeks has been to say, we need to look at our own side, and we need to look at the other side. Right now, we're not subjecting our side to critical evaluation, but we're very happy to subject the other side to it. So I'm trying to set us up for how we proceed from here.
Just a comment on what a good teacher is. And in my experience, a good teacher is someone who shakes everybody's minds up from your conceived ways of thinking and makes you think more. And I think you did that here.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I think it's so easy to get in our ruts. Remember the first week I had a slide of a rut, and I'm trying to get us out of the ruts. Please.
I felt that a lot of the slides that you put up, you had contrasting points. And I felt with every one, as you kind of opened up last week with making sure we get our definitions right, I felt that even the words that were on the slides in many cases were like the famous phrase somewhere on the spectrum. And you could put either definition at one end of the spectrum or the other. And the reality for many of us is that we are somewhere on the spectrum of that particular topic, not necessarily always on the left or far on the right, but somewhere in between. I just felt there was this gradation on definitions. You know, I mean, and it just comes through with, you know, the way you structured the slides to present each topic with the word sides, our sides, their sides, you know, good side, bad side, the same thing applies. There is this spectrum on all of these topics.
And some people are, they could be all on one side, but have one issue that they feel really deeply about that just shoves them way over to the other side. So this, again, it's a chance for self-inspection. It's a chance to think about some of this stuff, because there aren't many sources out there that really try to look at, set up a way to look at our thinking, our practices, our habits. And I think if we could start to do that as a church and as a society, our nation could be healed. I believe that. And that's where this is going. Yeah, please.
Also thinking about terms. I don't want to be a semanticist or whatever here. But for example, when you said fighting experts, it's ironic that the church has experts like yourself or pastors. And yet the church is also the place where those values and those deeply held beliefs get conveyed. And that fits on both sides of the sort of extremes that you've laid out. How do we deal with that?
Well, I think, how do we deal with the extremes that... I mean, obviously, this church is different from this is it South Hills Bible Chapel down the road? And I don't know anything about that church at all, so I make no judgments about it. But I think the same basic move has to be the same in both churches. It has to be, this is my culture here at this church. And how do I speak a prophetic word to my culture? And I would hope they would be doing the same thing. How do they, wait a minute. And one way of doing that that I've been trying to suggest is, even if you ask somebody, what does that, you're using this word all the time. I don't think that word means what you think it means. What do you say when you talk about justice? You know, what does it mean? Last week, if you get a chance to look, there was a, I talked quite a bit about words that have double meanings, or at least two meanings, and how people often don't bother to explain what they mean. There's not a Christian in the world, I would venture to say, who doesn't believe in the importance of justice, caring for the poor, charity, visiting the sick. Everybody believes that, but we have very different ways we believe those things. And I think if we understand how different people believe them, we have a much better chance of learning from each other and healing the wounds that we inflict on each other. I'm not aware of the time. Oh, sorry, I'm over. Thank you all very much. Lord willing, I'll see you next week.